What measures? Ballard, what evidence do you have? You were letting your issue with the Levis take this over, and Kenny took evidence from the crime scene at the dancers. Evidence that it was a cop. What are you talking about? What did he take? A piece of a holster that came loose when the shooter pulled his gun. I was there. I saw him take it. That and the wire. He knew it was a cop. Carr looked off for a moment as he composed his thoughts. He then leaned down and in close to Ballard. Listen to me. What you saw was Chastain covering his own tracks. He was the shooter, and you have fucked this up beyond belief. Now I'm going to go in there and talk to Olivas, and I'm going to try to salvage this and save your job. Carr signaled to one of the officers in the control center to unlock the door. He then looked back at Ballard. If you're lucky, you'll end up riding a bike on the boardwalk, he said. But at least you'll still have a badge. You don't understand, Ballard protested. There's evidence. I don't want to hear it, Carr said, cutting her off. I'm going in. The jail officer walked over to a wall unit of small lockers. He opened one and removed the key from its lock. Okay, you need to put your weapons in here, he said. Sidearm, backup, knife, everything. Carr walked over and put one of each into the locker, pulling his holstered sidearm off his belt, then a folding knife from his back pocket. He leaned one hand against the wall so he could raise his right leg, pull up the cuff of his pants, and detach an ankle holster containing his backup. The jail officer closed and locked the wall compartment and handed Carr the key. It was on an elastic band that Carr snapped around his wrist. He then looked at Ballard. I hope to fuck this doesn't bring me down with you. The officer opened the door to the interrogation room and stepped back to allow Carr in. Carr walked across the threshold and toward the table where Olivas sat. Ballard followed Carr, and the jail officer closed the door, locking them in. Carr started to turn when he realized that Ballard had come in behind him. I thought you... Ballard grabbed Carr by the right arm, and in a move taught to her at the academy and long practiced since, yanked it behind his back while throwing her left shoulder into him. Carr pitched forward across the empty chair and table. At the same moment, Olivas rose from his chair, revealing that his hands were not cuffed, and slammed Carr chest down on the table. Olivas put his full weight down on Carr as Ballard pulled the handcuffs off her belt and worked them around Carr's wrists. Good, she yelled. Olivas then dragged Carr completely across the table and flung him onto the seat where he had just been. He grabbed him with two hands by the jacket collar and pulled him up into a sitting position. He then hiked a thumb over his shoulder toward the upper corner of the room. Smile for the camera, Carr, he said. What the fuck is this? Carr demanded. How to separate you from your weapons, Ballard said. Everything seemed to dawn on Carr. He shook his head. I get it, he said. But you've got it wrong. You can't do this. Yeah, we can, Olivas said. We have a warrant for your weapons. He had a hip holster on today, Ballard said. Olivas nodded. Of course he did, he said. His shoulder rig was falling apart without that screw cap he lost. Listen to me. Carr said. I don't know what you people think you have, but you've got no probable cause. You are totally... What we have is your thumbprint on that cap from your rig, Olivas said. How's that end up at a crime scene, when you were nowhere near that crime scene? Bullshit, Carr said. You don't have shit. We have enough to run ballistics on your guns, Olivas said. We match them up and we'll have a six-pack to run across the street to the DA. And it will be adios, motherfucker, to you. Ballard added. Funny how being a cop worked against you, Olivas said. Most guys would get rid of the weapons. Hard to do that when they're registered with a job. Tough to go into the boss and say you lost both your guns. So my bet is that you kept them and thought you were going to skate. Carr looked stunned by the turnabout of events. Olivas leaned down, put his palms on the table, and recited the Miranda warning. He asked Carr if he understood his rights, and the detective ignored the question. This is wrong, Carr said. This is fucked up. You killed Chastain, Ballard said. You killed them all. She had stepped close to the table, her body tense. Olivas put his arm out as if to block her from launching herself at Carr. You knew you had lost that button off your holster, she said. You had access to the task force room and you checked the evidence report. It wasn't on there, and that's when you knew somebody was working it off book, somebody who knew it was a cop. You're crazy, Ballard, Carr said, and soon the whole world will know. How'd you know it was Kenny? She asked. Because he was the lieutenant's golden boy? The only one who'd risk going off book on this? Or didn't it matter? Was Chastain just the fall guy because you found out he carried a 92F and owed money? You just figured you could pin the whole thing on him? Carr didn't answer. We're going to find out, Ballard said. I'm going to find out. She stepped back and watched as a cold and instant reality seemed to fall on Carr, covering him like a thick black blanket. Ballard could read it in his face as he went from confidence to crisis, from thinking he had a shot of talking his way out of the room to visions of never seeing daylight again. I want a lawyer, he said. I'm sure you do, Ballard said. Chapter 42. For the second time in the day, Ballard was walking evidence through analysis. She didn't need a go-to in the firearms and ballistics unit. It was a case involving the murder of an LAPD officer, which automatically moved it to the front of any line. And to be sure, Olivas had called ahead and put his considerable weight behind the need for urgency. A ballistics expert named C.P. Medor would be waiting for her upon arrival. The cold truth that Ballard was carrying with her, along with the gun seized from Carr, was that the DA's package they had used to batter Carr with was not as strong as they had boasted. Since the VMD processing was a rarely used forensic procedure, and it was handled in this case wholly outside of the police lab, it would be open to heavy attack by any defense attorney worth his weight in objections. Detective, are you telling this jury that this critical examination of evidence was carried out by college students in a chemistry lab? Are you expecting us to believe that this so-called evidence was literally stolen from the crime scene and then FedExed to this college lab? What was additionally troublesome was the chain of evidence issue. The key piece of evidence with the suspect's fingerprint was spirited away from the crime scene without documentation. Chastain was now dead, and Ballard was the sole witness who could place the holster button at the scene. Her own personal history with the department and her credibility would come under withering assault as well. The bottom line was that they needed more. If either of the guns taken from Carr was matched to the dancer shooting or the Chastain hit, then that case would be as solid as the Santa Monica Mountains, and Carr would be crushed under its weight. The cases were fraught with sentencing enhancements, known as special circumstances, murder of a law enforcement officer, home invasion, lying in wait. Any one of these could put Carr on death row, and all three would practically guarantee it. While the state of California hadn't executed an inmate in a decade, and there was no indication that things would change in the future, it was still known to both cops and convicts alike that a death sentence was a ticket to insanity when the years of isolation, 1 hour per week out of the solo cell, began to take their toll. Facing that, Carr might be willing to plead out to get a deal that took death row off the table. He'd then have to admit his crimes and their motivations. He'd have to tell all. Medora was there and waiting with another tech at the entrance to the gun unit. Each man took one of the separately packaged weapons from Ballard. The first stop was the tank room, where they fired shots from the guns into the water, thus producing spent and undamaged bullets, suitable for comparison to the slugs removed from the victims in the two cases. They then entered the ballistics lab and set up at a comparison microscope and went to work. "Can you do the Ruger first?" Ballard asked. She wanted the answer on the Chastain murder as soon as possible. No problem, Medor said. Ballard stood back and observed. She had seen the exacting process done dozens of times before, and her mind shifted to what had happened back at the city jail after Carr had been arrested, and Olivas had set assignments for the investigation's new direction. Ballard was given the ballistic assignment, while three other detectives were assigned to Carr, and ordered to take his life down to the studs in an attempt to link him to the men murdered in the booth at the dancers, and to learn the motivation behind the massacre. Olivas gave himself the assignment of apprising command staff of what was happening, and of the need to alert the department's media managers. It was unlikely that Carr's arrest would stay under wraps for long, and the department needed to get out in front of the story. When it was all said and done, and people started going separate ways, Olivas told Ballard to hang back for a moment. When they were alone, he put out his hand. The gesture was so unexpected that she shook it without thinking. Then he wouldn't let go of hers. "Detective, I want to bury the hatchet," he said. "This thing shows what kind of investigator you are. You're smart and you're fierce. I could use you back on my team, and I could make sure it happens. You'd be back working days, unlimited OT. A lot of good reasons to come back. Ballard stood there speechless at first. She was holding the evidence bags containing Carr's weapons. "I need to get these to firearms," she said. Olivas nodded and finally released her. "Think about it," he said. "You're a good detective, Ballard, and I can turn the other cheek for the good of the department." Ballard had turned then to leave the jail. She walked out, thankful that she had held back from swinging the evidence bags and raking Carr's guns across Levis's face. As she watched Medora at the microscope, she tried to move her thoughts back to the case. There were still many questions and loose ends. Chief among them was the missing Matthew Robison. Once Ballard learned that it was Carr's thumbprint on the holster button, she started running the facts of the case through the new angle of Carr as killer. She saw the connection that had eluded her before. Carr had been part of the major crimes task force that had taken down a human trafficking cabal at the port on Friday morning. She had seen him herself on the 5 o'clock news. She realized now that Robison, last seen by his girlfriend on the couch watching TV, could have seen the report and recognized Carr from the night before at the dancers. He then could have picked up the phone at 5:10 p.m. and called Ken Chastain to tell him. It was that call that set several things in motion. Chastain now had further confirmation that the dancer's shooter was a cop. He had to go out and wrangle Robison to lock down his information and make sure he was safe. The question was, who got to Robison first, Chastain or Carr? As a major crimes detective, Carr had routine access to RHD computers, as well as to the division's war room. If he was back reading the dancers' case reports as they were coming in Friday, he could have picked up on Robison and been suspicious of Chastain's dismissal of him as a witness. In trying to cover the fact that Robison had apparently gotten a good look at the shooter, Chastain had labeled him as DSS, didn't see shit. The effort may have had a completely opposite effect in that Carr might have thought Chastain was trying to camouflage a solid witness. Carr was the shooter, so he knew that the chances were good that someone in the club had gotten a look at him. He very likely would have been checking witness reports to see if that was so. Ballard came out of these thoughts when she saw Medora step back from the microscope and ask the other tech to take a look. She knew he was soliciting a second opinion, because a lot was on the line with this case. Ballard's phone buzzed. It was a block number and she took it. "Ballard, anything yet?" It was Olivas. "Your man CP's on the scope. Shouldn't be long. You want to hold? It looks like he's just getting a second opinion." "Sure, I'll hold a minute." "Can I ask you something?" "What is it?" Carr knew I had been calling Matthew Robison to try to find him. When I asked him how he knew, he said that after Chastain got hit, RHD pulled a warrant for Robison's phone records in an effort to find him. Was that true? Or was Carr trying to cover that he had Robison's phone because he had killed him? "No, we did do that. We first tried to ping his phone, but it was turned off. So we pulled the call records to see if there was anything there that would help." "Why, Ballard, what's it mean?" "It means he might still be alive out there somewhere. Chastain may have gotten to him and hidden him before Carr even knew about him. Then we have to find him." Ballard thought about that. She had an idea but wasn't up to sharing it yet, especially with Olivas. Just then, Medora turned to her from his lab bench. He gave her a thumbs up. "Lieutenant, we've got the first match. Chastain was killed with Carr's backup. We've got Carr cold." "Excellent. We'll start putting a package together for the DA. Let me know on the other weapon as soon as you know." "You want me on the package?" "No, my guys will handle it. Have you thought about my offer to come back to the team?" Ballard hesitated before answering. "Ballard?" Olivas prompted. "Yes," she finally said. "I thought about it, and I like the late show." "You're telling me you're going to pass?" Olivas said, surprise clearly in his voice. "I pass," Ballard said. "I went to you this morning with the Carr print because it was your team's case, and there was nowhere else to go with it. And I knew I could use you to draw Carr to MDC. But that's it. I'll never work for you again." "You're making a big mistake." "Lieutenant, you tell the world what you did to me, and you own it. And then I'll come back to work for you." "Ballard, you..." She disconnected the call. Chapter 43. The second ballistics comparison was a match between Carr's service weapon and the slug taken from Gino Santangelo's brain. Late in the day, Carr was charged with 6 counts of murder, with special circumstances added on the Chastain kill. That night, Ballard returned to the late show. After roll call, she and Jenkins took the plane wrap and drove up Wilcox to the Mark Twain Hotel. They parked out front and pushed the button on the front door to gain admittance. When they had been partners, Ballard and Chastain had worked a murder-for-hire case in which they needed to stash the intended victim for a couple of days so that her husband would think she had disappeared, as he had paid an undercover officer to make happen. They had put her in the Mark Twain. The following year, they had another case where they used the hotel to stash two witnesses, brought in from New Orleans, to testify at a murder trial. They needed to make sure the defense could not find them, and attempt to intimidate them and dissuade them from giving their testimony. It was Chastain who had picked the place both times. The Twain, as he called it, was his go-to stash house. Ballard told Jenkins her theory about Robison being alive, and he agreed to take a ride with her to the Twain. After she held up her badge to the camera over the hotel door, Ballard and Jenkins were buzzed in. When they got to the desk, Ballard showed her phone to the nightman. On the screen, she had Robison's driver's license photo. "William Parker, what room's he in?" she asked. William Parker was a legendary LAPD police chief in the 1950s and 60s. Chastain had used the name for one of the witnesses from New Orleans. The nightman didn't look like he wanted any part of the trouble the police could cause in the middle of the night at a hotel where most customers paid in cash. He turned to a computer, typed a command, and then read the answer out loud. 17. Ballard and Jenkins moved down the first floor hallway until they stood on either side of room 17. Ballard knocked. "Matthew Robison," Jenkins said. "LAPD, open the door." Nothing. "Metro," Ballard said. "My name is Detective Ballard. I worked with Detective Chastain, who brought you here. We're here to tell you it's over. You're safe and you can go home to Alicia now." They waited. After 30 seconds, Ballard heard the lock flip. The door opened 6 inches and a young man looked out. Ballard was holding her badge up. "It's safe?" he asked. "Are you Matthew?" Ballard asked. Yes. "Detective Chastain brought you here?" "That's right." "It's safe, Matthew. We'll take you home now." "Where's Detective Chastain?" Ballard paused and looked at Robison for a long moment. "He didn't make it," she finally said. Robison looked down at the floor. "You called him Friday and said you just saw the shooter on TV," Ballard said. "Didn't you?" Robison nodded. "Okay. Well, we're going to take you by the station first to look at some photos," Ballard said. "After that, we'll take you back to your apartment and Alicia. You'll be safe now, and she's worried about you." Robison finally looked up at her. Ballard knew he was trying to decide if he could trust her. He must have seen something in her eyes. "Okay," he said. "Give me a minute to get my stuff." Chapter 44. Ballard got to the water late that morning because of the drive up the coast to collect her dog. By the time she had pitched her tent on Venice Beach and was walking toward the surf with her board under her arm, the morning layer had completely choked off the sun, and visibility was low. She stepped in undaunted. It had been too long since she had been on the water. She spread her feet to the edge of the board's rails and bent her knees. She started digging deeply into the water and shocking her muscles with the workout. Dig. 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 Glide. Dig. 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 Glide. She headed straight out into the fog and soon she was lost in it. The heavy air insulated her from any sound from the land. She was alone. She thought about Chastain and the moves he had made. He had acted nobly on the case. She thought maybe it was his redemption. For his father. For Ballard. It left her bereft and still haunted by their last encounter. She wished in some way they had settled things. Soon her shoulders began to burn and the muscles of her back cramped. She eased up and stood tall. She used the paddle blade as a rudder and turned the board. She realized there was no horizon in sight, and the tide was in that short moment of stasis before it shifted. It was not going in or out, and she wasn't sure which direction to point the board. She kept her momentum with languid paddle strokes, all the while looking and listening for a sign of land. But there was no sound of waves crashing or of people's voices. The fog was too dense. She pulled the paddle from the water and twirled it upside down. She wrapped the handle in hard on the board's deck. The fiberglass produced a solid sound that Ballard knew would cut sharply through the fog. Soon afterward, she heard Lola start to bark, and she had her direction. She paddled hard again and started to glide across the black water, heading toward the sound of her dog. As she came through the mist and caught sight of the shore, she saw Lola at the waterline, panicked and frantically moving north and then south, unsure, her bark now a howl of fear at what she could not understand or control. She reminded Ballard of a 14-year-old girl who had done the same thing on a beach a long time ago. Ballard paddled harder. She wanted to get off the board, drop to her knees in the sand, and hug Lola close.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Late Show, written by Michael Connelly, read by Catherine Menick. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Dennis Kale. Sound editing by Sean Bolter and Ian Lehman. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. The Late Show is also available in print and as an ebook from Little Brown and Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by Hieronymus, Inc. Audio production copyright 2017, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. Deduplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.